Representative Lee?
I move the minutes.
Representative Lee moves the minutes for March 3rd. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Minutes for March 3rd are adopted. Thank you, members. Since we have a lot more testifiers this time, I thought we would go over quickly some of the rules of the committee because folks may be new here. So we appreciate your interest and participation in the legislative process. We ask for your cooperation in maintaining decorum and civility throughout the hearing. For the safety, security, and comfort of all the attendees, please note the following guidelines. Signs and place cards are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause or other audible demonstrations are not allowed. For safety reasons, standing or sitting in walkways and aisles or standing or obstructing at your chair is prohibited. If you require any accommodations, please speak with our sergeant staff, identified by the gold ties. Troopers and house security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. And if you receive an entrance ticket, please retain it as it may be required for re-entry if you leave the hearing room. Really appreciate folks cooperating with this. We want to run our proceedings efficiently and safely. So with that, the first item we have on the agenda today is a presentation from the Violence Prevention Project Research Center. And we have Dr. Jillian Peterson and Dr. James Densley here. They do research. Their research center is based at Hamline University. The center is dedicated to reducing violence through evidence-based approaches, and they've conducted many large-scale research studies. Dr. Peterson and Dr. Densley are here today to present research around the mass shooting epidemic in our country, along with a look into school shootings. Copies of the slideshow are in your packet. But members, I just really want to acknowledge that this is a really difficult topic and a difficult presentation to listen to that we'll be covering, but feel like it's really necessary for our committee to have the information as we look how to keep our students safe in our schools. So with that, Dr. Peterson, Dr. Densley, welcome to House Education Finance Committee, and thank you so much for being here today and being willing to share your research. And now that you're already settled in at the table and we're all queued up, go ahead and state your names for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is James Densley.
And I'm Jillian Peterson. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's a great honor to be here, and I also, as you'd mentioned, want to reference, I think, why we are here, because of terrible tragedies that have occurred here in the state of Minnesota, and they do weigh heavy on all of us, and that is something that we will be talking about and putting a little bit of research context around here today. So the Violence Prevention Project Research Center, as was mentioned, is based at Hamline University, and we are a nonpartisan, nonprofit research center. And our goal is to generate knowledge and information that can be of use to practitioners and policymakers. And so this opportunity here today is directly aligned with our mission, which is to try and speak directly to the public in a way that can inform decision making. We are driven by the data and by the research, and that is what we are here today to talk about. Our research into the life histories of mass shooters in the United States was a project that began in 2017 and has continued ever since. In 2018, we received funding from the National Institute of Justice, which is the research arm of the Federal Department of Justice. This was under the first Trump administration, to conduct life history research into mass shooters in the United States. We built a database of mass shooters, anyone who had killed four or more people in a public space. That was the definition that the federal government was aligned with at that time. And then we also conducted interviews with perpetrators of mass shootings who were incarcerated, with family members who knew those perpetrators, with survivors of shootings, with victims' families, with first responders, and with others. We spent time in the communities where these tragedies occurred. That research is all documented in a book. It's called The Violence Project, How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. But since then, our work has expanded. in recent years, in part thanks to funding that we received from the Minnesota Legislature in 2023, we were able to expand this research to look at all different forms of violence in society. We now have databases that track homicides of any form when they have occurred, not just mass shootings, not just with firearms, but any form, in a variety of different institutional settings. That includes a house of worship, that includes workplaces. We're building one at the moment which looks at hospitals. But we also have within this college and universities, and of particular importance to this audience, K-12 school settings. Now, before I pivot to the actual data and the findings, I want to just make a few clarifications clear. So within this database, we have nearly 400 cases of homicides that have occurred in a K-12 school between the year 2000 and 2025. So that is after Columbine. That was deliberate to look at the period since then to the present day. Of that data, we have hundreds of people who have been killed and hundreds more who have been injured. But only a small subsection, about 8% of that database, will be what we would call active shooter scenarios. Active shooter is a definition used by the FBI, somebody moving indiscriminately, killing through space. However, those active shooter cases account for 26% of the deaths in the database and 60% of the injuries in the database. So they are a particularly deadly and tragic form of violence. Now, within the definition of active shooter, there is also another definition, and that is for mass shooting cases, which we are defining as four or more people killed. So for instance, the Annunciation tragedy would fall under the active shooter scenario, but it doesn't fall in the four or more killed category. This is not to put any in a hierarchy. It's just definitional for data purposes and the way these things are coded. Now, with that being said, four or more people killed in a K-12 school, if you go all the way back to the 1980s, there are 15 cases for which that is true, perpetrated by 17 individuals. You'll recall, like Columbine, there were two perpetrators. So that's the difference in the math. These are the cases. They're on the screen in front of you. They're high-profile cases. They're many of them are very familiar to you. Parkland, Sandy Hook, Uvalde, and so on. Of these cases, they constitute about 3% of all of the K-12 homicides in our database, but again, 26% of the deaths. And it's for that reason that now we're going to dive a little bit deeper into the dynamics of those particular cases, those 15 cases with 17 perpetrators. And for that, I'm going to pass over to Jillian.
Hi, everyone. So as was mentioned, I'm a professor at Hamline University in the criminology department, but I'm actually a psychologist by training and executive director of the Violence Prevention Project Research Center there. I'm going to talk briefly about some of the trends that we identified when we did a deep dive into these K-12 school mass shootings. So the first one that jumps out is that shooters are insiders. The vast majority of perpetrators of school shootings are current students or former students. The vast majority are current students, right? And then there's another 25% or so who are former students. That matters a lot when we think about things like school security, when we think about things like hardening, when we think about things like drilling, right? The perpetrators are running through the drills. The perpetrators move in and out of the security every single day. They know where the armed officers are. They know the procedures. They know how schools respond when a shooting happens because they've been drilling for it since they were 5 years old, right? And so I think a lot of the things that we design, sort of the underlying assumption is that we're trying to keep outsiders out, these bad guys out, when the reality is the most likely perpetrator is an insider in the building. They tend to be young male students of the school. So of those 15 cases, there's one transgender, or 17 cases, I'm sorry if you count everyone, one transgender individual, 16 males, and they tend to be young because they're current students. So the average kind of falls in that 15 to 17-year-old male range. We've done a lot of work in this space, sort of thinking about how do you approach this problem when you know the perpetrator is an insider, right? It makes it harder from a security perspective because you can't lock them out because there's students there. But it actually makes it easier in a way from a prevention standpoint because these are actually young people that we're seeing every single day and people can notice warning signs and build systems to sort of respond to those warning signs. So some of the work that we've done around drills has found that drills tend to, there's more and more research saying for certain students they can be quite traumatic, for students who have experienced violence in their home or in their neighborhood, for students who have certain disabilities or anxiety, they can really increase fear. And we now have a couple of cases where we know that the perpetrators of school shootings became initially fascinated by school shootings from running through drills at a young age. And so there is this sort of social contagion piece of it that I think we have to be really cognizant about. The second finding is that shooters are in a noticeable state of crisis. So we define crisis as a noticeable, a marked change in behavior from baseline. So they are acting differently than they normally do in the days and weeks leading up to the shooting, and people around them are noticing. They are not thinking that this person is planning a mass shooting necessarily, but they are noticing that something's different, right? That they're paranoid, that they're agitated, that they're aggressive, that their behavior is different. The most likely people to be noticing this is family, is peers, is teachers, people who see these students on a regular basis. The third common finding is that mass shootings, they are a final act. The perpetrator wants to be known for this. That is the goal, right? So you go in knowing you're either going to kill yourself, be killed by the police, or spend the rest of your life in prison. Your goal is to make the history books, to make the headlines, to make your grievances with the world go viral, to force us all to read your manifestos and watch your YouTube videos, to be a part of the people who have done this before. So because of that, perpetrators go in knowing they're not coming out. That can be tricky in terms of, I think that's different than other forms of violence, right? Where we think if we put some armed person on the scene, they're not going to do it. Well, if you plan to die, that's not necessarily a deterrent. But it has a lot of implications if we think about suicide prevention. If you want to be alive, you are not going to do this. And so if we can use what we know about suicide prevention in terms of homicide prevention in this space, that can be really powerful. The fourth common finding is that shooters study other shooters. They spend a lot of time reading about, watching, delving into spaces that really celebrate previous mass shooters. They're often connected more and more so in online spaces, Discord rooms, Reddit threads, where mass shootings are really celebrated, where violence is seen as a solution, where people are sort of pushing each other towards violence, and where previous perpetrators are very much heroized. They see themselves in previous perpetrators, which I think is why we tend to see the same profile emerge again and again, and they want to be a part of this group, right? They want to be the ones heroized in these spaces afterwards. So thinking about how we stop young people from getting on that pathway to violence, oftentimes the entrance point is kind of edgy or gore violent content. And then algorithmically, you are quickly moved into spaces, whether you like it or not. And so thinking about the role of social media companies, I think, in some of this radicalization process is important to be thinking about. Fifth finding, perpetrators tell other people they're gonna do it before they do it. The official term is leakage in the criminology space. That just means kind of telegraphing your plans in advance. When it comes to school mass shooters, 94% tell somebody in advance that they are going to commit violence. This could be an online post. This could be in person. The most common way they do it is they tell a friend. We've had cases where dozens of students knew that something was going to happen and nobody told an adult. That is your prime space for intervention. The problem is, I think a lot of times when we intervene, we tend to criminalize or expel, and that can be appropriate in some cases, but in many cases that can actually intensify the grievance. So there's been a lot of expelled students that have come back and committed a school shooting, right? It's not a problem we can necessarily expel our way out. Because the anger is directed at the school, that actually intensifies the crisis. So thinking about how we actually bring the crisis down, right, and kind of pull that student in, that's something important to be thinking about, which I'll touch on. So there's different strategies for what we do in this space. Minnesota now has a targeted prevention, a tip line where you can report tips that they will respond, right? A behavioral threat assessment and management program. That can be useful at the state level if people are actually reporting tips and they are being responded to sort of quickly and immediately. What we see sometimes in these spaces is that law enforcement might look into a tip, determine that it was a joke or it was a hoax or the person doesn't actually have access to weapons, and then their job really is done because there is no immediate threat. But there's another layer too, which maybe if you're just joking or maybe if it's just a hoax this time, that doesn't mean that it's not going to be real the next time, right? And so thinking about how do we really dive in with these students and figure out what they need. We've spent the last 3 years building a model in the St. Paul Public Schools called a CARE team. This was another federally funded 3-year project. The CARE team was essentially a threat assessment team rebranded to kind of be softer and gentler, essentially, to make it so teachers and parents and mental health professionals felt more comfortable reporting kids, not because they thought, you know, this middle schooler was a threat, but they thought that something was really wrong with this middle schooler and they were in need in some sort of care. And so what you want is collaborative spaces where you have school security, you have mental health, you have administration, you have people from the community all gathering information, all trying to get at the root of what's going on with this student, building an intervention strategy, and then following up and seeing if it's working. A lot of this is just about kind of communication and information sharing. What we find is when things go wrong and it's the worst case scenario, a lot of times there was lots of different people holding a piece of the puzzle and it just didn't get put together until it was too late. And so creating systems that bring those pieces together, not so we can necessarily identify and criminalize school shooters, but so we can say, hey, it seems like you're in a crisis and we're noticing that and we need to intervene and get you some help. We also, through that care process, came up with a lot of different intervention strategies, right? It could be counseling. Sometimes it could be basic needs. It could be mentoring programs. It could be community partnerships. It could be a check-in with your favorite teacher on a Friday afternoon. When we interview perpetrators of school shootings and mass shootings, we would always ask the question, is there anything or anyone that could have stopped you? And every single time, the answer was yes, right? Like one guy even said to us, I think anyone could have stopped me. Right. And so I think sometimes we can get caught in these, like, yes, we have all these big policy things to think about and talk about. But when a school mass shooting gets averted, it's typically a human connection. It's typically someone connecting and getting them through a crisis. And so how do we create schools where we are doing that with kids on a daily basis? The final finding is that because perpetrators are young, because they tend to be students of the school, they are not legally able to purchase firearms due to their age. There are some exceptions to that, of course, but for the most part, they can't. So they take guns from family members, usually, sometimes friends, sometimes straw purchases, but most likely they're taking unsecured guns from family members. We've started to see more criminal prosecutions in that space of family members who were not safely securing their firearms and they were used. But safe storage strategies can be really helpful here. And what we know from research is the best way to change someone's behavior around safe storage is a conversation with somebody they trust, right? And so how do we empower principals and pediatricians and people to be having those conversations, especially if you have a kid who's showing high risk? So in terms of what this all means, and again, we wrote a whole book about this, I could talk for hours, but very briefly what this means, because perpetrators are insiders, we have to think beyond doors and drills and kind of the reactive stuff we've been doing to reduce casualties and really get at true prevention. because shooters are in crisis, things like knowing the signs of a crisis, having everybody trained in crisis intervention, having reporting systems, knowing where to take that information. The fact that these are final acts means that suicide prevention strategies can be really helpful. And essentially everyone in this school, right? It's not necessarily just the counselor with the letters behind their name that is the right person. It could be the football coach. It could be the shop teacher. There's been cases where a janitor talked down a perpetrator, right? So making sure that everybody has the skills to be able to do that. The fact that shooters study other shooters means thinking about how do we help young people navigate social media and their media consumption? How do we inoculate kids from going down those dark pathways? And potentially how do we hold social media companies a bit more responsible from stopping kids from going down some of those really dark pathways? The fact that perpetrators leak their plans means things like behavioral threat assessment and management can be useful, whether that's big at the state level or at a local school level and having your own type of internal system. It means you need reporting systems, anonymous reporting systems we know are really useful. Kids don't like to tell on their friends, and so if there's a way for them to do that anonymously, and also just strong relationships between kids and adults in the building can really increase reporting. And then finally, things like having conversations around secure storage and potentially using extreme risk protection orders in cases where a kid is really at risk and there's firearms in the household. And just lastly, I think one thing that we are very clear about, there is no one solution to this problem. I think sometimes we can get caught poking holes in different solutions and be like, well, this one isn't perfect. This one's not going to solve it. There is no one thing that's going to solve this. So we like to use this idea of a Swiss cheese model, right? When you start layering imperfect solutions on top of each other, the holes start getting covered up. So we're not going after what is the one solution that's going to solve all this, but here's 30 different things we could try, and if we start layering them, maybe we will start to have a real impact.
So we started this conversation about the different forms of violence that affect schools. I want to share now very briefly some other findings of research that we've been involved in, looking at the changing nature of homicide in the Twin Cities. There's a series of papers that support this. We're happy to share the full papers with the committee. In the interest of time, I'll share the top line findings because they are important. You might recall that during the pandemic, there was a nationwide spike in serious violence. There is now a trend in it going down, which is much better, but we were interested in what was potentially driving that spike, particularly here in the Twin Cities. We conducted research in prison where we interviewed homicide offenders. Some of them were teenagers who had perpetrated these crimes during that time and were those in and out of the school system. Some of the things that we found is that these were individuals with existing vulnerabilities, that they were accelerated by the institutional gaps that were created during the COVID pandemic and the murder of George Floyd. A lack of trust in our institutions, but also a lack of access to our institutions. Kids weren't in school, they weren't in after-school programs, they weren't in extracurricular activities, instead they were on the streets. And everyday conflicts were escalating and spilling over into violence. Why this is important is because we've just had a very long presentation about the exception, not the rule, when it comes to serious violence in schools. The rule is the vast majority of school violence is the spillover of community violence. It tends to occur in the places that we don't talk about, parking lots, sports events. It tends to occur when community struggles, such as gangs, are then being faced in the school building. So when we think about school safety, it has to be multifaceted, and it has to approach this from not a one-size-fits-all perspective, but recognizing that different problems need different solutions. However, what was common is in the perpetrators that we interviewed, they were definitely dealing with the same existential crisis of self, that this lack of empathy, this lack of understanding of who I am in the world, this desperation was a common through line in both the everyday homicide offender and the high-profile mass shooter. So I'll close with one other thing, which I want to leave you with because it's important for the work that we do. The ripple effects of this violence are huge. We conducted a national survey of 10,000 Americans. You know when you hear the things on the radio when someone does a poll? It's usually at best 1,000. This is 10,000, which gives us a lot more statistical power to draw inferences. We defined in this particular study a mass shooting just as four or more people shot, not four or more people killed. And what we found is that 7% of respondents said that they had been physically present on the scene of a mass shooting in their lifetime. 2% had been physically injured. Now, among those who'd been exposed to the many forms of gun violence that we documented in this study, there was an increased mental health impact. Many people were living with, in some cases, extended periods of post-traumatic stress, anxiety, and depression, which was changing their routine activities. There is now a fear of being in public spaces because of the impact of gun violence. This is especially true in K-12 school settings. What we found in this study is the generation that is the most impacted by this level of gun violence is the youngest generation. They are the ones who are having this put on them on a daily basis. So that's the challenge, I guess, is to do right for the youngest generation, which is why we're having this conversation in the Education Committee. And so with that, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Dr. Densley and Dr. Peterson. With that, we'll go to member questions. I think Representative Quam raised his hand first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And some clarification on the data set. You defined a data set of 15, but a few slides later, you brought up the Grover Cleveland, which was outside that data set. It'd be nice if you can let us know what portions of data set you're using for which slides. And then of the 10,000, what proportionality were from rural or small towns?
Good questions. So the
Dr. Peterson?
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
No worries.
So, yes, all of the data that we talked about in these findings was based on those 15 mass shootings. We did use this because this is a strong illustration. This case is not actually in the data, but a really nice sort of illustration of someone saying, I committed this shooting because I wanted to die, which is why it's used on the slide. But all of the data was from that mass shooter study.
And then with regard to the other question, it's a nationally representative survey. So it matches through a synthetic sampling frame the population of the United States. So it perfectly matches the whole country.
Representative Quam,
so,
follow
yes,
up.
It does represent rural communities in that sense.
Thank Representative you. Quam, follow up?
Yeah, just if you can give, because I believe it's over 50% live in a metro, and any clarification of the data of, you know, metro or large city versus small town, and there are sometimes different dynamics that are involved. I was just curious about those details. Thank you.
Dr. Densley, anybody want to respond? No?
I would say we can certainly get you that data. I'm happy to send that for you. We can pull those numbers.
Thank you. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. I guess my question is, it seemed like there was someone alluded to social media kind of maybe driving this, but I'm just also curious if you'd looked into the why, and it seems like there's a lot of anger to result in this kind of an output. And so if you could comment on that.
Sure, I can take
Dr.
that.
Dr. Peterson.
What I would describe these as angry suicides, right? So one sister of a perpetrator we interviewed talked about how her brother, who's a very well-known perpetrator, went from kind of being like, what's wrong with me? Like, why am I like this? Why don't I have anything? Why don't I have friends? Why don't I have a girlfriend? What's wrong with me? To whose fault is this? And the way that he got there was through an online site that was kind of very misogynistic and hateful towards women. So I think what we find is that it's people who are angry or people who are depressed, despair, suicidal, looking for who to blame. And some people pick a gender, some people pick a religion, some people pick a race, but it's like, this is who I blame for my problems. And so I'm not just gonna kill myself, I'm gonna take all these people with me. So I force people to see me and force people to see that rage and that anger. So certainly that is absolutely a big factor here.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is just kind of regarding correlation as opposed to causation. So some of the things that have been noticed amongst the data set of the perpetrators of these shootings have been things like exposure to prior shooters, exposure to social media, having access to firearms, and those are certainly alarming correlations. My question is, when you look at the larger control group, I mean, we got 50 million kids approximately in public education who very well may have those same correlations but don't engage in these behaviors. What's your research indicated as to the extent to which these factors are causal versus just correlations?
Dr. Densley or Peterson?
I can start. I mean, so this is the problem with social science research in this space, right? You cannot do causal research. We can't set kids up in certain ways and then have a double-blind experiment and see who does a mass shooting. Right? It will never happen. So the best research we can do is causation. We do have a control group problem here, for sure. We've spent a lot of time actually thinking about who is our control group, right? Is it other forms of violence? Is it the general population? Is it boys of a certain age? That is a constant. That's a constant problem that we're constantly thinking about. We're actually really trying to understand right now for kids who engage in these really violent online spaces, like how do we identify who is the most at risk and who's not? I think one thing we advocate for is as long as you are building a system where you are approaching this with care and concern, and you are intervening with care and concern, worst case scenario, you cared about somebody who wasn't in need of as much care as you thought they were, right? Like, so as long as we're not having this really punitive attitude and it's sort of like, you seem like you're really fascinated by this, how do I dig in? How do I get to know you? How do I figure out what's going on? Those type of systems, I think they can't necessarily hurt.
Dr. Densley, did you have anything to add?
Sure, yeah, it's a fantastic question.
Yeah.
Really good point. And I would just add, one of the other things we've talked about with this is an analogy really with like susceptibility. So if you think about when we had these conversations around the COVID-19 pandemic, for instance, there was a lot of talk about that, you know, if you were in a care home, you were more susceptible to COVID. If you had pre-existing conditions, you were more susceptible to COVID. We have these conversations as a public health approach. I think there's a similar analogy that's drawn with some of this, which is to say, there are some people who are more susceptible to the influence of what is on social media, for instance, because of the existential crisis that they're in and the way in which that is manifesting itself, which gets them into that pathway. But I think you're absolutely right with this idea that because we don't have that control group, you're trying to do the best interventions to have the maximum amount of impact without doing any harm, which I think is the key.
Representative Hudson, follow up. Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. One question I had is, out of your study and the people that you had looked at, is there a common thread like with toxicology reports? You know, is it something I just haven't heard us really, and maybe you know more, but like really break down? Is there any kind of common thread of like, antidepressants, ADHD, you know, I'm very concerned about the over-medicating of our children and what consequences those are having on our children.
Dr. Peterson.
Sure. So, and I will note, all of our full data set is publicly available for free. Anyone can download it, interact with it. So each perpetrator, there is 201 perpetrators in the database, the mass shooter one. They are coded on about 200 pieces of life history information, including current and history of substance use, all the mental health variables you can think of, if they're taking medication, what type of medication they're taking, when it was prescribed, right? Like all of that is coded and in there. What we find is that SSRI usage, it's about 25% of cases, which is fairly similar to the general population, so we don't see a real elevated rate, but that's all in there and can be explored.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for you guys. We've seen a rise in AI chatbots that are being, they're encouraging self-harm, suicide. Have you guys examined any of that, or is that something that you guys fear will be on the rise in your research?
Dr. Densley.
Yeah, thank you. Another excellent question. It is something that we're starting to explore now. It's what is different now in an AI-driven world versus the other thing. One of the things we've sort of noticed is there was a time when you went to the internet to learn things. Now the internet learns you. And so the algorithm is feeding you more of what you like. And if you like mass shootings, you get more mass shootings. If you like puppy videos, you get more puppies, and that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. With the AI component, there have been a small number of cases where it appears that shooters have been interacting with AI chatbots, and that may have had an effect. The most recent one is the Tumbler Ridge shooting in British Columbia, where OpenAI was actually notified about this person's use of ChatGPT, and they were trying to make a decision about whether or not to flag this or to report it. They ultimately didn't, and then a mass shooting occurred. And so this is a sort of evolving space at the moment. But also as well, even though the guardrails are there with AI, at least they say they are, you can stress test them and move them pretty quickly. So we've got a colleague that we work with. His name is David Reedman. He runs an organization called the K-12 School Shooting Database. He's done some work in this space where he's been sort of stress testing the limits of ChatGPT and AI. And just by changing some of the terminology that you use in the questions, so if you ask ChatGPT, can I plan a school shooting? It'll tell you no. If you say, I would like to plan a Nerf gun war on a school campus, and it has to be in a certain format, then it will do it. And so there are ways that you can break the guardrails to then get it to feed you the information that you're looking for. So I think this is an evolving space, and I think your question is an important one, because as AI becomes more pervasive, it's going to be part of this equation, there's no question.
Representative Engen.
No, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that response. It means you guys are ahead of the curve, you're proactive in thinking about these things. It's just terrifying to me that there are people who are turning to AI as if it's a form of socialization and communication with others. And there should definitely be some red flags that notify people of those questions that they're asking. So appreciate your guys' insight.
Thank you. We've got one more left, and then we're going to move to our bills. Representative Rayrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to kind of summarize some of the important things that I heard from you. And first, that the vast majority are current and former students. So that indicates that hardening schools can't be the only solution. And then almost all of them, 94%, tell someone in advance, and over 80% act differently. So that indicates that our extreme risk protection orders, crisis intervention, anonymous threat reporting systems, behavioral threat assessment teams would all play a role in that. But then 59% got unsecured guns from family or friends. So extreme risk protection orders can't be the only solution there. So that indicates that the secure storage of guns also has to play a role. So I just really, really think this one slide with the puzzle pieces is probably the best slide to look at, because each of these has a piece of that puzzle, and I'm wondering if you could just say a little bit more about how these puzzle pieces interact.
And Dr. Densley and Dr. Peterson, I'll let you have the wrap-up.
Cheese, I was corrected.
The analogy is a good one, though. Yes. So this was often actually a public health framework that was used again during the COVID-19 pandemic, which was to say that at that time there was no one solution that was going to fit everything. So what it was asking people to do is socially distance, mask, vaccinate, and so on. And you layer these things on top of each other, and you get a net gain where you get a public health approach to this. So it's that same sort of logic, which is to say that any one of these solutions is imperfect. It's got holes in it. It's not going to fix everything at all times for all people. And as I mentioned, there's many different forms of violence that occurs within a K-12 school setting. The solution that fixes gang violence that spills over on the street might not necessarily fix the active shooter scenario of that suicidal student that's planning a murder using ChatGPT, for instance. But if you layer the different imperfect solutions on top of each other, the holes start to fill in and you get toward a more perfect solution. So in many ways, this was sort of our way of saying, we know that the politics is difficult on this. We get it. We watch the news. We understand. We know there are divisions on party lines sometimes. We're not searching for the one ring to rule them all, right? My Tolkien reference, I am an Oxford grad. We are searching for solutions that when you layer them on top of each other can get us toward the one thing that we all agree on, and that is that kids need to thrive mm-hmm. in schools, that kids deserve to be safe in schools. Families shouldn't be afraid to send their kids to school. And in doing that, we honor the victims of the past tragedies mm-hmm. and of the survivors that are living with both seen and unseen wounds from these past events. So that's the idea behind this, which is, you know, is there an opportunity to get behind imperfect things that aren't going to meet every solution, but if you layer them on top of each other, you get toward a better option. That's the idea.
Representative Lee, only if it's really quick, because I want to move to the bills.
Yes, thanks, Chair. Very quickly, I just wanted to thank our presenters and also make sure that we don't lose the point that the presentation before us, make sure we don't take for granted that this is a public health approach, and it's really important to approach this problem of gun violence in our schools from a public health perspective rather than like a criminal or a punitive perspective. I think that's important because our students are not criminals. So want to make sure that that's the takeaway from this.
Thank you, Representative Lee, and thank you again, Dr. Peterson and Dr. Densley, for being here. We really appreciate all the work that you've done. I'm sure it's heart-wrenching to do this work as well, so thank you so much. With that, members, thank we're going to move on to Representative Green's bills. And while she is getting ready, we'll have Tim Strom has some handouts to go over, I believe.
Madam Chair, members, I know your time is quite limited today. There are two documents in the folder regarding school safety and the Safe Schools revenue. The first is a three-page handout that talks about the revenue, shows the functional spending across the different areas, and then shows other state aid approaches in addition to the Safe Schools levy that have been used over the last 10 years to fund safer schools. The second document's a district-by-district printout on Safe Schools that matches House File 2717, but for work with House File 3653, where the increase is $1 per pupil, one can just multiply the pupil counts by the additional dollars to arrive at the rough cost of each of those parts of the proposal. And then third, when you get to the student and support personnel part of the discussion, there's also a printout there showing the by category the amounts in that category as well.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. And with that, members, Representative Green, would you like to move? What we're going to do is we're going to move House File 3635, but we're going to have a discussion, and your testifiers go towards both bills, House File 2717, and then we'll do the amendment on. Should we do the amendment first?
Yeah.
We'll do the amendment first on 3635 after you describe your bill. And then after that is all settled and we lay it over, we'll at the end we'll bring up House File 2717 to then also lay over. So first, why don't you move House File 3635 before the committee for possible inclusion?
Thank you so much, Chair. I move House File 3653 for possible inclusion.
Would you like to briefly just, well, actually, let's get the bill in the shape you'd like it in. So would you like to move A1 before us?
Yes, please move the A1 amendment.
And do you want to explain the changes the A1 makes?
Yes, thank you, Chair. The A1 amendment just clarifies that funding that would go to co-ops, go to co-ops that provide direct services for students.
Thank you, members. Any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no. The A1 amendment's adopted. With that, Representative Green, go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you so much, Chair. I just want to take a moment. I mean, that was a lot that we just heard, and so I just want to settle us in and ground us in so we can have a really good conversation. You know, when I was on the school board, we talk a lot about students, and then all of a sudden they turn into data points, and it always kind of pings my heart just a little bit, and so I just want to make sure that we're always remembering these are all humans, so even though the information is excellent to have. So, that said, you know, House File 3653 and House File 2717 is really about making sure our schools have the resources they need to keep students safe. We've heard this morning, but even, you know, we've talked a lot about this, that there's not one single solution to doing this. It requires a really comprehensive approach. It's got to be shaped in collaboration, and it's got to be grounded in the voices of the people that are closest to the schools. Our students, teachers, principals, education leaders across Minnesota. And we heard again this morning the important role that prevention has. Safe school funding gives districts flexibility to determine what their schools and what their students need. And what safety looks like in one district may look different than what it looks like in another district. But these dollars allow local leaders to plan accordingly. And most importantly, the students themselves are always telling us what they need. Across the board, every survey I have seen, the number one issue that comes up is mental health. I talk with a lot of kids a lot of times, and whenever I ask, they always say mental health, mental health. I'm actually really proud of this generation, because when I grew up in the 80s, nobody talked about it. So kudos to this next crew coming along. One of the things I want to mention, though, is the allowable uses of Safe School Levy funds have really expanded over the last couple years before my time here being a legislator. It includes cybersecurity. It includes mental and chemical health supports, suicide prevention. We just talked about the importance of that a few moments ago, student supports, and then, of course, facilities and infrastructure improvements as well. Yet districts are still expected to do the same, even though all of those categories have been added in, and that simply isn't sustainable. The last time the Minnesota legislature increased safe school funding was in 2013, when the per pupil amount was raised from $30 to $36. In the years since, expectations and needs around school safety, as I said, have grown significantly. So the one bill that I have, House File 2717, simply updates that authority for school districts to levy for $44 per pupil. And then I want to talk about House File 3653, which takes a different approach. I really wanted to take a moment to really assess what do our kids actually need. Not looking at the budget, and that's not to be irresponsible, but it's really to look like what are districts telling us that they need. And when you pull all of Minnesota's public school systems under one umbrella, our charter public schools, our co-ops, our intermediates, our public schools, districts, we really have a lot of robust and services and opportunities for students all across the state. And so we need to make sure that we're meeting the needs of all of those students. And so this bill does direct aid for those public school entities, providing $100 in direct aid to all those different places per student. And that's what the schools are asking. And so that's why I brought that bill forward. We know this isn't sustainable. And so I'm going to bring up some testifiers. And I know there's a big list on here, and I'm excited to hear what people have to say. So I think we're ready to move on to testifiers. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Green. And as we said, we have 3635 before us, but we'll also be discussing with the testifiers House File 2717. And with that, our first testifier we have here is Marcy Dowd, Superintendent of Intermediate School District, And since we have another chair, why don't you, Dennis Lehmar, Superintendent of Benson, come up. Thought I saw you in the crowd. With that, we have, I think all the testifiers have been told to keep it under 2 minutes, please, because we have a lot of you. So, Superintendent Dowd, go ahead. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Yes, my name is Marcy Dowd. Thank you, Chair Joachim and members of the committee. I'm the superintendent of Intermediate District 287. For those unfamiliar, intermediates are cooperative agencies that support member districts. We provide primarily special education services in federal setting 4, which is the most restrictive educational environment. Students are referred to us when their special education needs, often involving aggressive behavior, mental health needs, or physical and medical needs, cannot be met in a traditional district. I am here today to advocate for an increase in Safe Schools revenue, both on behalf of intermediate school districts and a member of AMSD's executive committee. AMSD's legislative platform calls for an increase in Safe Schools revenue by 100 per pupil unit for school districts and 35 per pupil unit for intermediates and cooperatives, which is outlined in House File 3653. Having spent most of my career in traditional districts and now leading an intermediate, I recognize that school safety more than ever. It's what keeps us up at night. It's the top priority that we think about every single day. However, how we achieve that is different, and it's important that this funding is flexible to meet local needs, whether it be through physical security supports or mental health. Our district employs a multi-layered approach to safety, much like the Swiss cheese you just heard, fundamentally built on strong relationships and mental health support. We reinforce this foundation with student safety coaches and behavioral specialists who are essential in supporting our students when they become dysregulated or aggressive in our schools. Given the population we so proudly serve, we experience multiple incidences, critical incidences, and mental health crisis on a daily basis in all of our buildings. We also provide a therapeutic teaching model in collaboration with Wilder Foundation. This model combines intensive therapy units within the educational environment for those that are experiencing chronic mental health needs. Student support aid funds this model as well as Safe Schools revenue. Safe Schools funding has enabled us to upgrade physical security measures, including installations of weapon detection systems, much what you all went through today. We also invest in emergency notifications for internal and external threats, as well as enhance our cybersecurity to support and protect our student data. Despite all of these layers, the need to address both the physical and psychological needs of our students is critical. We need to have a safe learning environment for our students. I also have to acknowledge the funding that we get for Safe Schools only covers a portion of all of those layers of safety. I want to thank you for your support and increased funding on this need to keep our schools safe for our students.
Thank you, Superintendent. And since you were speaking for AMSD, too, I'll let you go a little bit over. Superintendent Laumeier.
Madam Chair and members of the House Education Finance Committee, good afternoon and thank you for your time. My name is Dennis Laumeier and I proudly serve as Benson Public Schools Superintendent. I'm here today on behalf of MESA, MREA, and MSBA to testify in support of House File 3653 and House File 2717. Legislation that would increase and strengthen Safe Schools funding for Minnesota schools and cooperatives. Safe Schools funding plays a critical role in protecting our students and staff, which we just heard about. However, that funding has not increased since 2013. In that time, the cost of maintaining safe and secure school environments has risen significantly. At Benson Schools, we use our Safe Schools funding to help cover the cost of our school resource officer. Since 2015, the cost of our resource officer has increased by more than 37%. When the program began, Safe Schools revenue covered that expense. Today, it does not cover half. We now must use general fund dollars to make up the difference, dollars that would otherwise support classroom instruction and student programming. What would additional Safe Schools funding do for Benson Schools? With additional funding, Benson Schools would prioritize student safety and well-being by fully funding our school resource officer, by adding additional social workers and adding additional school safety measures. Without additional funding, districts are increasingly forced to make difficult decisions. Do we direct limited resources toward academic programming or toward student safety and security? Student safety, of course, must always come first. A safe, secure environment is a foundation for learning. But safety funding should not come at the expense of classroom opportunities for students. These bills increase Safe Schools funding so that it better reflects current costs and inflation. They also provide important flexibility, allowing districts to determine how best to meet their local safety needs, whether that means supporting additional personnel, investing in student mental health services, strengthening secure entrance, or enhancing other facility safety measures. Additionally, these bills expand revenue access to cooperative districts that share responsibility for our student services, and they increase the minimum revenue amount for a smaller district like ours. For schools like ours, that minimum matters. It ensures the funding is meaningful enough to truly make a difference. Schools are grateful for the Safe Schools funding program, but without updates, it no longer keeps pace with the realities we face. These bills recognize that school safety funding is not optional, it is foundational. I respectfully encourage this committee to support House File 3653 and House File 2717 to ensure safe and secure learning environments our students require. This funding is not just a request, it is a necessity. And finally, I just want to reiterate what was stated here early by our wonderful researchers that kids deserve to be in safe schools. This funding will allow that necessity. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Thank you to Superintendent Lamar. Since you were also talking for MREA and Mass, I let you go a little bit over. But for the remaining testifiers, please keep it under 2 minutes. Thank you. Next up, we have Nicole Woodward and Joya Sheenan.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nicole Woodward, and I'm the Executive Director of the St. Croix River Education District, a cooperative unit serving six member school districts in Greater Minnesota. I am testifying today in support of House File 3653, a bill that would provide much-needed safe schools aid that would directly benefit the student programs we run in service to our member districts. Under the current aid model, any costs associated with making our Setting 4 and transition programs safe and secure fall back to our member districts, putting increased financial strain on districts whose budgets are already spread too thin. As a result, these member districts are faced with an incredibly challenging decision in investing in their local needs or those in the programs operated by the cooperative. They shouldn't have to choose. Our safety-related needs are just as substantial and varied as an independent school district. Recent examples identified in our system include walkie-talkies, student support personnel, reinforced secured entrances, doors enhanced with delayed egress, crisis prevention programs, strengthened infrastructure for cybersecurity, protective Kevlar clothing for staff, and even a fence to prevent our most vulnerable students from accessing a nearby lake and busy highway. Last year, district budget constraints paired with a grant application that went unapproved resulted in several of these needs going unmet. As a result, our students and staff continue to work in environments that are less safe and less secure than they deserve. We need this aid. We need it to be intentionally and directly distributed to cooperative units, and we need the authority to use it flexibly to meet our unique needs. Approving this bill sends a message that the safety of all students and all educators is a top priority regardless of the type of organization that serves them. Thank you for your strong consideration of House File 3653.
Thank you. Now I think I have it right for a change. Executive Director Chinan.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joey Chenyon. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools.
I will get it right, I promise.
Thank you for this opportunity to testify. Minnesota has over 170 chartered public schools serving over 70,000 students, about 8% of the state's public school population. Our students are diverse. Roughly 66% are students of color and American Indian students. Over 60% qualify for free or reduced lunch, and 25% are English language learners. School safety is a top concern for students, families, and educators. From community violence and firearm concerns to SRO gaps and cybersecurity threats, the challenges are real and growing. Chartered public schools are doing everything they can to create safe, secure environments, but they are excluded currently from Safe Schools revenue. Traditional districts currently receive $36 per pupil for local safe school revenue through the levies, but chartered public schools are excluded because they cannot levy. As a result, charter schools must pull safety costs directly from classroom budgets, shortchanging instructional resources in order to pay for things that would be covered by this funding stream, security upgrades, suicide prevention efforts, violence prevention tools, to name a few. There are many ideas currently being discussed about how to provide and expand school safety funding to include more types of schools. There are areas of agreement and areas of disagreement, but one common theme has emerged that charter school students should receive this funding. This is reflected in HF 2016, a bipartisan bill that received a hearing last year. We sincerely appreciate Representative Green's bipartisan work on this issue to move this issue forward and to find a practical solution. All Minnesota public school students, including the 70,000 who attend chartered public schools, deserve equal resources for safe school environments. There is bipartisan support for addressing this inequity by including charter schools. Charter school students deserve safe school funding this year, not next year, not someday. We respectfully request that the legislature fix this unequal funding structure and provides equitable safety aid for charter public school students at the same amount that district schools receive. Our students deserve fairness. Our families deserve peace of mind. All public school students deserve equal resources for safe learning environments. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Dr. Megan Forget and Tim Benz. Why don't you join us at the table? Once you get settled, go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, Megan Forget. My name is Megan Forget, and I am the Associate Director of Quality and Excellence in the Office for the Mission of Catholic Education at the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis. I'm not here today to speak against these proposals. Each increases funding or expands eligibility for safe schools revenue, and that is a good thing. Rather, I'm here to express the hope of the broader non-public school community that all students, as a matter of public safety, are included in safe schools funding. On August 27th, my office and I were forced into a crisis response and still ongoing recovery as we worked to support Annunciation in Minneapolis. Having to see and watch so many families and community members suffer horrific terror and loss at this non-public school just 6 months ago, I can tell you that school violence hit students in both public and non-public schools. Since the Annunciation shooting, many of our Catholic schools have tried to add in further security measures, such as hiring security officers or monitors at doors, better securing their front entrances, and increasing mental health support. Despite what some may think, many non-public schools in Minnesota run on bare-bones budgets while working to serve vulnerable, low-income, or unique populations of students. Our Drexel Mission schools serve over 1,700 students, primarily minority students and their families, who routinely qualify for free or reduced meals. These families come to us looking not only for educational quality and excellence, but safety and security that they have not found elsewhere. Why should these families, along with other students and their families who pay the same taxes as their public school neighbors, not be shown their safety and security matter too? This is really a question of public safety and protecting all students in an equitable and inclusive manner. Just as in the gun debate, where we should not let politics drive policy, we should not deny this protection to some of our students merely because they do not use public schools. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you so much. Next up, Tim Benz. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Tim Benz, President of Independent. Chair Youakim and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I come before you with a network of 188 non-public schools in our organization. Just for context, there are about 72,000 students in all non-public schools across the state. I'm here to express concern about House Files 3653 and 2717, which extends school safety and security funding except for students in non-public schools. Beginning in 2020, Mindependent and our fellow non-public school partners have advocated that school safety and security funding must include students across all sectors of our educational system. In 2023, following a shooting at a non-public school in Tennessee, we once again reaffirmed our request to ensure equitable treatment for students in all school settings. Unfortunately, final legislation excluded students attending non-public schools. House File 3653 and 2717 exclude students in non-public schools, including students that attend Annunciation. As stated in this committee previously, holistic and comprehensive plans for safe school communities are critical, including physical enhancement, staff training, and mental health resources. Legislation should be viewed as a common good. Numerous states, including New York, New Jersey, and Indiana, include non-public schools in their safe school safety programs. What happened on August 27th at Annunciation must never happen again. This time is now to enact legislation that provides stable, flexible, and equitable resources for all schools, and not the time to segment and exclude students just because of their educational choice. Students are students, and every one of them deserves a commitment to a safe and secure school experience. Thank you for the opportunity today.
Thank you. Next up, we have Mike Rogers and Shannon Peterson. Once you get settled, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mike Rogers from Risen Christ Catholic School in South Minneapolis. Good afternoon, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify and share my concerns about House Files 3653 and 2717. I serve as president of Risen Christ Catholic School in South Minneapolis. We serve 300 students in kindergarten through eighth grade. Our school community is vibrant, diverse, and deeply committed to academic excellence and faith formation. 9 out of 10 of our students qualify as low income, and 99% are students of color. Like every school in Minnesota, we face real challenges, and like all schools in Minnesota, we see the protection of students entrusted to our care as a primary responsibility. Our teachers and staff work hard every day to keep students safe. We also have plans to enhance security and student safety. Of course, these plans cost money. That is why I am here with serious concerns about House Files 3653 and 2717. While these bills propose meaningful investments in school safety, they exclude non-public school students. I strongly encourage the committee to include all students. Non-public school students already receive textbook aid and transportation aid, just like public school students. Our students receive free meals, just like public school students. But when it comes to safety and protecting children, why are we suddenly proposing to treat them differently? Risen Christ is located just 2.5 miles from Annunciation. We have staff members whose own children were inside Annunciation Church on August 27th. The names of some of the children who were injured in the attack are familiar to us. These are our colleagues, our families, and our friends. I cannot think of a justifiable reason to exclude non-public school students from this funding. All children in all types of Minnesota schools are our children. I strongly urge that any school safety legislation must be inclusive of all students. School safety should not depend on whether a child attends a public, non-public, or charter school. Every Minnesota student deserves protection. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Next up. Thank you.
Chair Joachim and members, my name is Shannon Peterson. I'm the Executive Director of Lakes International Language Academy, also known as LILA. I'm here to urge your support for HF 3653 and specifically for including charter schools as eligible recipients of safety aid. Charter schools are public schools. Our students are Minnesota students and their parents do pay taxes. Yet charter schools receive only about 70% of the total public funding available to traditional districts. Because charter schools currently receive no safety aid, essential safety expenses come directly out of our already limited educational funds. To give an example, after the Annunciation shooting last August and the unusual example of a shooter attacking from outside of a school building, some of our elementary teachers experienced significant anxiety at our next lockdown drill because we did not have window coverings on our ground floor classroom windows. We had to remove our old curtains last year to meet updated fire code requirements, but have not been able to replace them in our limited budget. The cost will be more than the cost of one teacher's annual salary. Still, buying curtains has become an important factor for the peace of mind of our staff and families. In addition, we have a need to hire staff or open time in existing staff schedules so they have the capacity to check in with and connect to vulnerable students who might be considering violence. A Addressing mental health needs is also currently a balancing act. Do I eliminate teacher positions and increase class sizes so that we can spend more of our small budget on mental health professionals or curtains? Charter public school students need the same potentially life-saving public school support for their districts, for our schools, that their district school neighbors can currently rely on. I respectfully ask you to support HF 3653 and ensure charter schools are fully included in the Safe Schools revenue. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next up we have, lost my place. Okay, Siobhan Wilson, Anaya Ray, and then on deck, Kate Olson, Alexander Fitzsimmons, and we go to a final remote testifier. Thank you for being here today. And we'll start with Siobhan Wilson. Go ahead and state your name for the record and then proceed.
Hello, my name is Siobhan Wilson and I'm an eighth grade student from Sojourner Truth Academy. Today we'll be talking about school funding for charter schools. I like my school for many reasons. Our great sense of community, the things taught and learned to me, the family and friends who go to my school, not to mention the many things we're taught from history, math, reading, and even science. We also learn about community building and basic life lessons that prepare us for our futures. However, there's a problem. We are a charter school. Not only that, for many other charter schools, they have the same problem. It's funding. Why is it a problem? Not just because of our school, but many and all other charter schools in Minnesota receive less than unequal funding. If charter schools in Minnesota get the funding they need to help and support themselves and the students and staff in those schools, but what's the difference? First, traditional public schools receive $36 per student to use on safety expenditures and eligibilities, those being school security enhancements, student and staff safety measures, violence, crime prevention tools, costs of licensed counselors, nurses, social workers, sped workers, security psychologists, kin dependency staff, and teachers. These certain things matter to me and my classmates. These are the things that traditional schools have gotten from the funding they've received, thus gaining those eligibilities. This means, unfortunately, the many students and staff who are at these charter schools are excluded from safe school funding, which means many of these charter school students, including me and my classmates, have less safety and no eligibilities to support us, even though our parents pay for the taxes which go to the non-charter schools in Minnesota. However, there can be a change. In 2019, the legislature passed a one-time safe school supplemental aid for all school districts and charter schools. Even though this was a one-time safe school plan, one-time safe school plan is opened the way for an opportunity to help fix the greater future where all schools get the funds they need to help to have top education, admin, and to support the students of our future generation. So in conclusion, this is why we need to pass the plan to provide equal safe school funding for chartered public school students. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for your testimony. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Linnea Ray. My name is Linnea Ray. I am a seventh grader at Sojourner Truth Academy. I chose my school because it's close to my house. I like our diversity and the teachers. My school is different because we have different celebrations for different cultures. My school is a public charter school, and my parents have to pay taxes that go to Minneapolis public schools and help with the safety of Minneapolis public schools when chartered public schools have to take money from their budget to pay for safety aid. And that's not fair. Why are my parents paying taxes for safety and it goes to Minneapolis public schools when I go to a chartered public school? Shouldn't my parents be paying taxes for safety aid to the school I go to, not a whole other school district I'm not even a part of? I haven't personally had an experience with my safety or an experience that has impacted my safety, but my peers have. It still affects my safety, though. And we're kind of located in an area where there is a lot of dangerous activity. I remember there was a time when I was in sixth grade and my class was having indoor recess, but some of the boys still wanted to go outside, so my teacher let them. And then they came back saying a car drove by our school fast, and then they started letting off shots, so we had to go on code yellow. I feel like it's not fair for chartered public schools to not receive safety aid and have to take from their own school budget to have safety aid. With the money we can provide, the safety me and my peers need, and for us to be a school with a lot of kids, all of them need to be safe. Chartered public schools are excluded from the levies that increase taxes paid for by our parents. Chartered public schools should be included in the levies so that there is more equity in how they are funded. $36 per student would go a long way to helping our school. It's almost $14,000 this year. We want the legislator to address unfair funding in part by giving charter school safety aid now. We can't wait. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Kate Olson and Alexandra Fitzsimmons. Kate Olson, go ahead and state your name for the record, where you're from, and then proceed.
Okay. My name is Kate Olson, and I've been a teacher at Sojourner Truth Academy for, which is a chartered public school, for 22 years. I'm a special education teacher and one of the debate coaches. We are a public school. We receive money from the federal government, from the state of Minnesota. We comply with all expectations of all public schools that receive this money. We provide special education, multi-language learner services. We comply with required state testing. We follow the same expectations as Minneapolis public schools, yet we are denied equal funding under this current system. We're excluded from receiving funds through levy referendums. Chartered public schools receive less funding. As you've heard, on average, they receive only 70% of what traditional public schools receive. Today, I want to focus on how it keeps showing up, or how it shows up in keeping our schools safe for all students. There is an actionable funding issue I want to raise with you, that safe school funding from which chartered public schools are excluded. Traditional districts, as you've heard, have received $36 per pupil for a variety of safety uses. Chartered public schools, such as Sojourner Truth Academy, receive none of this money, which is provided through a levy, which is supported through the taxes I pay, through the taxes our students' parents pay. Chartered public schools do not get this funding, and that needs to change. I've been a resident of Minneapolis for 30 years, and I have voted yes on all school levies proposed in Minnesota because I believe all of the students in Minnesota deserve to have what they need to be successful scholars and amazing adults. I have no problem paying extra taxes to meet those needs. But none of that money comes to Sojourner Truth Academy or to any chartered public school within that city. Our school needs to ensure the safety of our students, and we have to find creative ways to pay for these measures. So this shouldn't be the case. There is $36 that should be provided to us for each student in our building. We have 383 students enrolled at Sojourner Truth Academy. We should have $13,788 available to help us ensure a safe school for those students. Something needs to be done to start eliminating these inequities in funding for our charter schools. This should never be an us versus them situation. These students are all our students. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Senior Policy Director with Children's Defense Fund, Minnesota. I'm here to speak in support of House File, my glasses, House File 3653 and House File 2717, because school safety and our children's sense of safety is fundamental to child well-being. According to the 2025 Minnesota Student Survey, only half of fifth graders and about 40% of 8th, 9th, and 11th graders strongly agree that they feel safe at school. While the 2025 Gallup poll found that 41% of parents feared for their child's physical safety at school, showing that concerns about safety exist both at school and in homes throughout our state. Students, families, and our broader community are continuing to heal from the tragedy at Annunciation Catholic Church and school. And the impact continues to painfully reverberate through classrooms and neighborhoods. For many children, it has reinforced anxieties about school safety and underscored the need for communities, educators, and policymakers to provide reassurance, support, and strong prevention programs that foster healing and restore trust. Research, including findings highlighted earlier in this hearing by the Minnesota Violence Prevention Project, shows that many individuals who commit acts of violence exhibit early warning signs. Schools with trained staff, threat assessment teams, and reporting systems can identify those students in crisis and intervene before harm occurs. Prevention also includes educating students and families on safe firearm storage. While schools cannot control what happens in students' homes, providing resources on the importance of keeping guns secured and out of reach reinforces school-based safety efforts and contributes to protecting Minnesota children. By expanding funding and access to Safe Schools programs, House File 3653 and House File 2717 move Minnesota toward a child-centered, comprehensive approach that strengthens both physical safety and emotional well-being. For the health and safety of Minnesota's children, I urge you to support both bills.
Thank you so much for your testimony. With that, members, we have final remote testifier, Tony Simmons. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Hey, thank you. My name is Tony Simmons, and I am the Executive Director at High School for Recording Arts. I am here to ask for equal school safety funding for all our public schools, traditional and charter. High School for Recording Arts has existed for over 27 years. We are a public charter school founded to meet a critical need within the community to re-engage young people who have been marginalized, pushed, or kicked out of traditional education settings. Most of our students reside within the St. Paul community and are predominantly of color and live below the poverty line. Our students mainly come to us having been out of school on average for a year and a half. We are re-engaging them in school through their interest in music, recording, and the exploration of various creative endeavors. This passion becomes the driving force behind their learning. When we ask our students why they come to our school, one of the primary reasons they cite is that they feel safe. Unfortunately, many of our students live in communities that experience a higher degree of violence, facing incredibly challenging life circumstances. The simple act of feeling safe anywhere, but especially in school, is paramount to them and us. Despite navigating past a school that oftentimes don't feel safe, they choose to come to our school. And when they do, they express that our school is a place where they feel safe. We take this responsibility to keep our students and staff safe very seriously. However, as security concerns within our community and our school get more complex and expensive, we strongly believe that our students should receive the same investment in their safety as any other public school student. We do not see any legal or moral reason for this public school funding difference. All of our applicable funding has been directly applied to ensure their safety. I'd like to emphasize that the state of Minnesota is receiving a significant return on this investment in our school. We have been cited for disrupting the school-to-prison pipeline. We implore you to recognize our students as public school students deserving the same degree of safety investment as any traditional public school student. And please recognize how this investment in their safety serves a vital public purpose. These young people deserve to attend a school where they are, where they feel safe, and know that the state is investing in their safety and education. This is a sound investment by the state of Minnesota in their safety, their future, and ours.
Thank you for being with us here today. Members, before us is House File 3857 as amended, but I want the questions to also, you can also address House File 2717. Thank you. I've mixed up my papers here. So with that, members, I have Representative DePell up first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As founding member and board chair of a non-public school, this is kind of an issue that's near and dear to me, and so I have just a couple quick questions for the record that I was hoping you could answer. The first one is, would Annunciation and all other non-public schools be denied funding through this bill or excluded? And with over 100,000 non-public students in schools around Minnesota, why are you excluding over 10%, actually about 12% of students in Minnesota? And is this an intentional exclusion of those students that we just heard we should be protecting all students?
Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative DePell, for the question.
I appreciate the question. You and I have talked in education policy as well about this. And, you know, I think there is no intention to exclude anybody. This bill is about public school funding. And that's why I brought it forward. It is how it's been done in the past as well, because we haven't provided direct aid to charter schools ever. So this would be an important first step for charter public schools to provide direct aid. And then the increase in the levy is also not direct aid. It is asking taxpayers in those communities to pay for that. So I just wanted to acknowledge that. But I do appreciate the question. And I think if we're going to have a conversation about non-public funding, I think we have to look at the big picture. Every student in the state deserves to be safe in their schools. And I'm not privy to how you run your school or how other non-public schools are run, how they do their budgeting, how they do their emergency response plans. And part of that is because they're not part of the transparency and accountability that comes with public school funding. So I think it's a conversation that we could have and should have, but I think we have to address what our duty is. And our duty is to fund public dollars to public schools, because every kid can come, no matter what kind of funding they have, tuition, endowment. There are no restrictions, and that's part of the beauty of Minnesota's public school system, I think. So,
Representative Powell, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, for the record, there are no restrictions for any student to attend the school that I'm the board chair of. We provide scholarships and funding for all families and never deny a student based on their income and ability to pay. Second to that, I wanted to address the issue of actually protecting the schools, which we talked about in part in a different committee, but we actually have a school safety plan. And I looked up all the numbers. There isn't a single situation where a permit carrying individual ever perpetrated a shooting on a school. And so to take away that ability to protect our own schools would be unfortunate. That was brought up in this hearing and in the testimony as well, nor has there been a gun taken from a permit-carrying individual and perpetrated a shooting perpetrated against the school. So those are really the only ways that schools, non-public schools, have to defend themselves, because as we heard, non-public schools are running on tight budgets. We don't have a lot of money. But we also want to protect our students. And so I would encourage this committee to think very long and hard how we can protect all students in the state and not just a select few while intentionally excluding others. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative DePell. I have Representative Engen, Representative Quam. I'd ask our members if we could, we won't have time for questions. We'll go to Representative Green's wrap-up as we move the bill. We have six testifiers that have come for Representative Senator Murray's bill, and I want to make sure to be respectful of their time. So, Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Green. I really appreciated getting to know you and you taking the time to sit down, even over the interim, and talk about some solutions for this problem. It's extremely near and dear to my heart. I remember sitting and watching as the TV was on after our teacher flicked it onto the news after Sandy Hook. And we have to do something. I think we all agree on that. I'm definitely disappointed that right now non-public schools aren't included in that, and I think that there are some workarounds to ensure that they are a part of that same transparency and accountability piece that we demand out of public schools, whether that's receipt expenditure tracking or some verification of the expenses as it comes to safe school dollars. But we can talk about that offline. But overall, I'm extremely disappointed in how reactionary we are to this issue. It seems as if the only time that we're talking about it is after another horrific incident occurs. And then in the news cycle for about 3 or 4 days, we talk about guns, use the same talking points back and forth on blame before it then evaporates from the news cycle and we do nothing for kids. We should be done with that model. We as a legislature should say that we're better than that. That while we have those conversations, while we have those disagreements, we're still gonna put something in place to protect kids and students, because right now they're completely vulnerable. Hearing from teachers who say that they only wear tennis shoes to school because they don't know if they need to run. Or they carry a baseball bat as a prop in the back of their classroom, but that's the only thing that they'll be using to protect themselves in an instance of an active threat. That's sad. That's extremely sad. And so we should continue to have these conversations, but know that every single student and their safety matters too. So I just want to say thank you.
Thank you, Representative Crum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, well, having been on a school board of a school that's one of the lowest per pupil funded and on the governing board of Zed Education District, which were multiple schools cooperating together to help students with special needs, students are individuals. And the options provided by these non-public schools are important. And they find themselves in places they can succeed. And it's not fair to deny these options the safety that we are providing with the funds. All kids deserve the protections that we're trying to pass. And I just wish that we could more fully include the other schools in this funding.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Baker, quick follow-up, then we'll leave it to the author.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Green. I just want to be very, very clear that from my perspective, I don't think there's a person in this room that doesn't agree that all kids should be safe when they go to school. Full stop. Kids need to be safe when they go to school. So, Representative Green, I 100% agree we should increase safe school funding. Where that money comes from, we're going to have a debate about that. If I had more time, I'd ask you. But so we agree with that. I also really appreciate the agreement and how you said, and I may have written this down wrong, but you said something to the effect that what safety looks like in one district may be different than it looks like in another. So the one-size-fits-all model that, frankly, we've seen from this legislature long before I was a part of it needs to change, and we need to provide the funding and the flexibility so that local schools can meet their individual needs. So thank you for that. There is a glaring difference between the bills that we heard last week and these bills. I heard one of the superintendents say, kids deserve to be safe in school. Totally agree. There's no one in here that would disagree. I heard another superintendent say all kids, regardless of the type of organization they go to, should feel safe. But in these bills, that's not true. Kids that go to non-public schools are excluded from this. And I respectfully just disagree with you about the tracking and the accountability piece from non-publics. Mm-hmm. We already have nurses at our non-public schools. They are getting food service. They're getting universal meals. They're getting counseling services. DFL members of this committee have bills to expand non-public pupil aid for elementary counseling. So they can do it. This is a choice. This is a choice to exclude. And if we are going to use non-public schools to fit a political narrative,
Representative Baker, I asked if you'd like a wrap-up, so can you wrap it up, please? We're going to the next bill. We're talking about public school funding right now.
You bet.
Thank you.
And if we're going to use non-public schools to fit a narrative that is trying to be driven, we need to be honest about it. We need to be funding all kids, period, full stop. That's what needs to happen. And if we are going to do anything, that needs to happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Principal. Representative Bakeberg. With that, Representative Green, we have House File. No, I got to get this right. 3653 before us as amended, and then we'll move 2717 before us too. But do you want to do a wrap-up for both, please?
Yes, thanks so much, Chair, and thank you, Representative Bakeberg, for your comments, and Representative Quam and Representative Ingen. You know, I appreciate that. I think we have to continue talking and having this conversation. You know, one of the things that I think we have learned from the Annunciation families is that What they're asking for is outside of the schools as well, and protections for kids in our state and keeping them safe. And that is passing sensible gun violence prevention bills. And they have asked for that. You know, I have a lot of Annunciation families that live in my district. And so I just want to make sure that when we approach this, we are approaching this with our eyes wide open to look at the whole problem. And I look forward to continuing the conversation with my colleagues.
Thank you. Like you have said, and like we've all said, this is just the start. That's why they're all being laid over. With that, members, we have House File 3857 laid over as amended. And then also House File 2717 moved before the committee for possible inclusion. Is that your motion, Representative Green?
Yes, it's my motion to move House File 2717 to be laid over.
Thank you. And since we've already had the discussion, I will move that House File 2717 be laid over for possible inclusion. Members, we are not going to be hearing House File 3451 today because we will not have time, but we will move to our safe, our student support personnel aid bill of Representative Spencer Murrow, House File 3857.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we have a little time, so I can keep my opening comments.
Yes. So would you like to move House File 3857 before us?
Yes, I would.
With that, go ahead.
So in 2023, we passed a new funding stream, Student Support Personnel Aid, which would provide districts, charters, and cooperatives funding to hire, and then we changed it to also be able to retain school counselors, school psychologists, social workers, nurses, and chemical dependency counselors. This funding stream is distributed on a per pupil basis with minimum amounts for districts and cooperatives. We had put in originally that this funding stream was supposed to increase, and it was supposed to increase from $17 per pupil to $48 per pupil last year with the budget. Due to some budgeting changes, we minimized that increase from $17 to $30, and this bill seeks to restore the originally anticipated funding of moving to $48 per pupil in 2026 and later. I see this as both a reactive and proactive bill. This is reactive in the sense that we know that our young people have been through so much in the last year. You know, I think we continually in this committee hear young people come before us and tell us that whether they are in Greater Minnesota or whether they are in the metro, they are telling us they are not okay. They are telling us that they need more support, need more mental health resources to be at school. And so this bill and this funding is both reactive to support students and processing the trauma of everything that has happened in their communities. And it's also proactive. We heard from our presentation earlier about the need for mental health support in school. We heard the really scary reality that the majority of people that will end up committing school shootings are our students. And we have an opportunity to proactively address the mental health needs so that the kinds of terrible violence that we have seen in our schools never have to happen. So look forward to hearing from our testifiers, and with that, Madam Chair, we can bring them up.
Thank you, Representative Spencer Murrow. Most of them are on remote, so we'll start with Dr. Molly Weeks. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Dr. Molly Weeks, and I'm on the board of the Minnesota School Psychologists Association. I'm a teaching assistant professor in school psychology at the University of Minnesota, where part of my time is dedicated to school-based practice within the South St. Paul School District. Within the last year, the landscape of education in Minnesota has been fraught with challenges related to school-based gun violence, violence at the hands of federal officials, federal funding cuts, and extended educational disruptions. Mental health needs are at an all-time high, and media depictions of a mental health crisis is not an exaggeration. Students in our schools need the safety and stability that student support personnel are trained to provide. But Minnesota faces unique employment challenges, including a decades-long shortage of school psychologists. We are in desperate need not only of new school psychologists, but methods to sustain and fund our current workforce. The funding this bill proposes to restore will help schools meet that needs. I loved my time working at South St. Paul, and like many school districts, they experienced significant budget constraints, and much of the funding that allowed my work to continue was prematurely rescinded by the federal government last year. The result of this dual funding shortage meant my contract was no longer sustained. My departure was filled with sad and frustrated goodbyes. Students were devastated and confused.
To them, it made no sense that money and politics were the reasons they could no longer look to me for support. Educators were angry with the systemic funding shortages and worried about their capacity to maintain services. Each conversation ended with, "What are we going to do?" And I had no good answer. Today I'm speaking in favor of increasing the student support personnel funding. As Minnesotans, we want to see children in our state flourish, to grow into happy and engaged adults who can support themselves and their communities. We do better when our children do better, and there's no greater investment in their well-being than helping ensure they have access to high-quality school-based services. Student support personnel are trained professionals with skills to meet the myriad needs of our communities, and we are worth the investment. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us. Flannery Clark, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Hello, my name is Flannery Clark, and I'm a volunteer with Minneapolis Families for Public Schools. I am here to read the testimonies of two families in hiding. From South Minneapolis, the ICE operation has created a long-lasting and severe impact on us as parents. Shortly after it began to affect us, it began to affect our children. The operation has provoked intense fear. They have been experiencing depression from being trapped inside. We do not feel safe to allow our children to attend school in person or leave our home. As much as we have tried to protect them, our children understand the truth of the situation we are living through. We have watched them change in ways we've never seen before. Every day they ask us difficult questions. We haven't been able to give them a definitive answer. Here are some examples. Why can't you bring me to school anymore? Why do we have to stay inside our home all the time? Why can't you go to work? Every day, they ask us if today is the day we can finally leave our homes. Please, we want the schools to help us, to have mental health professionals for our kids. If they get help, it will support them to overcome their deep fears and minimize a decrease in their academic performance at school. As parents, we cannot do this alone, and our children desperately need help. From another family. My children are living in terrible fear that they will be separated from us. They regularly say they are scared to not have parents. They constantly ask if we will come back. As children, they are unprepared to face the horrible situation. My kids live in constant fear. They go to school, but they have to, when they leave with our neighbors, they tell us they are scared to come home to an empty house. They ask all the time, "Mom, Dad, when will you be able to leave the house? When will you be able to take me to school?" We don't have good answers to most of their questions, and it breaks our heart. We need help. Our children need psychological support because they have been profoundly impacted by this. It has been hard for us as adults, but even harder on our kids. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for being under 2 minutes. Sarah Bernhardt, please state your name for the record and proceed. Okay, we're going to work on your, you're unmuted on our end. Can you check your end?
Able to hear me now?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Very sorry. So, my name is Sarah Bernhardt. I'm a nationally certified school psychologist speaking today on behalf of Minnesota School Psychologists Association in support of the Bill 3857. The Minnesota School Psychologists Association, we advocate for policies that strengthen student well-being and help schools meet the growing mental health and learning needs of Minnesota's children. Student Support Personnel Aid was created for a clear purpose, to expand access to licensed professionals such as school psychologists, counselors, social workers, nurses, and chemical dependency counselors so schools can respond effectively when students need help. These professionals do more than respond to crises. They help identify learning disabilities early, provide mental health support, strengthen school safety, and ensure students can access the education they deserve. The need is real and measurable. According to the Minnesota Student Survey, about 29% of Minnesota students report long-term mental health, behavioral, or emotional problems. Even more concerning, suicide is the second leading cause of death for our young people ages 10 to 24 in Minnesota. Research also shows that nearly 70 to 80% of children who receive mental health services access them for the first time in school settings. Schools cannot address challenges of that magnitude without trained professionals. Student Support Personnel Aid helps districts recruit and retain these experts so students receive support earlier. Interventions are more effective and teachers can focus on teaching. and there are signs that it's working. The 2025 Minnesota Student Survey shows the first improvement in youth mental health trends in more than a decade, including a significant decline in persistent depressive symptoms among high school students. That matters. That progress reflects intentional investments in Minnesota students. These licensed professionals do more than respond, and they need to continue to be funded, and this funding needs to be protected and limited to the licensed student support personnel. This bill would restore the funding to levels that allow schools to maintain and expand access to these critical professionals while ensuring transparency and responsible stewardship of public resources. Minnesota students deserve schools that are safe, supportive, and equipped to help them succeed. Thank you for your time and your commitment to Minnesota's children.
Thank you. Dr. Tasha Jess, please state your name for the record and proceed.
We do. My name is Tasha Just. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I serve as president-elect of the Minnesota School Psychologists Association and have had the honor of working in public schools for over 20 years as a licensed and nationally certified school psychologist. I'm here in strong support of House File 3857. In Minnesota, our current ratio is double the amount of recommended for school psychologists. If time were evenly divided, a school psychologist would have less than 75 minutes per student for the entire school year. That is about 25 seconds per student per day. There is a correlation in K-12 education that often gets missed. Staff talk about the honeymoon period at the beginning of the year. Part of what makes those first weeks different is that licensed student support personnel are not yet buried in evaluations. We're in the building, supporting students, supporting adults, reading systems in real time, and most importantly, identifying patterns before they become bigger problems. We're trained to see what is not being said before it shows up as a crisis. It is not just systems. We can intervene before behavior patterns are mislabeled as character flaws or intellectual deficits. The Student Support Personnel Aid was created for that prevention, but over time, its purchasing power has eroded. House File 3857 restores funding closer to its original intent and strengthens districts' ability to hire and retain licensed student support personnel. It also supports the districts and schools that don't have strong levy capacity. Access to school-based mental health should not depend on zip code. On behalf of MSPA, I respectfully ask for you to support House File 3857. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us today. Next up, Christy McCoy, School Social Workers. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
All right. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today to speak on behalf of House File 3857. My name is Christy McCoy. I am a licensed clinical school social worker with over 23 years of experience in St. Paul Public Schools and also serve as the legislative coordinator for the Minnesota School Social Workers Association. With perpetual youth mental health challenges, proper staffing isn't optional. It's essential for student well-being. The intent of the 2023 funding was to expand positions for student support personnel, such as school social workers, to address increasingly complex student needs that show up in Minnesota schools every day. This bill reinstates vital funding for schools to ensure sustainable hiring practices that support the social, emotional, and mental health services students depend on. Research confirms schools with strong school-based mental health support experience better academic outcomes, improved attendance, reduced disciplinary issues, and more. In collaboration with other student support personnel and administrators, school social workers provide mental health expertise in assessment, prevention, and crisis response. We also help to promote school safety and student well-being, utilizing evidence-based trauma-informed interventions, ensuring that all students thrive academically, socially, and emotionally. We address the social, emotional, and environmental barriers that impact learning. Utilizing a strengths-based systems perspective, we're able to provide direct services to students facing challenges such as trauma, food insecurity, lack of access to mental health care, disability, discrimination, housing instability, family stress, just to name a few. As youth mental health needs continue to rise, school social workers are not a luxury, we're a lifeline. Schools, as we all know, play a large role and a significant one in promoting resilience, healing, and the journey to well-being for young people, especially young people of color. Statistics show that Black, Indigenous, and students of color are 6 times more likely to receive mental health care and support in their schools compared to other community settings. Group work is one of the culturally responsive interventions I implement, which consistently shows positive academic outcomes and enhanced social-emotional well-being. For example, I co-facilitate a group for 12 BIPOC
I'm so sorry, we have very little time left. Could you just please do a concluding sentence?
Absolutely. I am so sorry. I just wanted to share on behalf of the Minnesota School Social Workers Association, Minnesota is making progress toward reducing caseloads because of the investments like House File 3857, so we can better immediately meet the mental health needs of our students in real time. So we ask for your support, and we appreciate all that you do on behalf of students all across the state of Minnesota. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, and it's nice to see you. Last up, we have Tara Cliff. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tara Cliff. I'm the president of the School Nurse Organization of Minnesota, or SNOM. We represent professional school nurses working in school districts across the state. And SNOM thanks Representative Kimura for the House File 3867. All students should have access to professional school health services. Less than half of Minnesota school districts employ a licensed school nurse, and nearly 25% of districts do not provide any health services to students. This data represents people and not necessarily equate even to full-time FTE. Data does not differentiate between full and part-time roles. Data further indicates that staffing levels and roles vary greatly by public school district size, and students in our smallest public school districts have lower access to professional nurses. School nurses help all students from preschool through transition age with urgent and episodic care, and play a critical role in coordinating, planning, and providing students with chronic health conditions such as asthma, seizure disorder, diabetes, severe depression, and mental health issues, just to name a few. 33% of children in Minnesota have one or more lifelong health conditions. Assessment and screening skills used by the school nurse can lead to early identification and referral to access to care and treatment for mental health problems, with responsibilities expanding far beyond bandages and ice packs. School nurses are critical frontline workforce in the community. As you heard last week in testimony, school nurses play a pivotal role in student attendance as well. According to the Minnesota Student Survey, 34% of students with both chronic conditions and anxiety and depression were chronically absent from school, compared to 18% of those with no chronic health conditions. The National Association of School Nurses outlines tangible benefits of investing in school nursing services, including improved academic outcomes, cost savings, time savings for educators, and an essential need for care. This legislation will provide additional funds to school districts to hire trained professionals who support student health and allow schools more opportunities to stay healthy, focused, and learning in our classrooms. For students who face barriers to accessing health care, especially those living in predominantly low-income, rural, and minority communities, a school nurse may be the only source of regular health care. Many health offices are staffed with secretaries or health
aides. Could you please wrap up your little over your 2 minutes?
Oh, sure. All students should have access to school nursing care by a registered professional school nurse all day today. And we welcome any efforts to help schools get more qualified and licensed professionals into our schools. Healthy students are better learners, and every student deserves access to a school nurse. Thank you.
Thank you for the testifiers. Sorry that we are running so short on time. I'm not seeing any member questions, so I'm going to turn the wrap-up over to you, Representative Spencer Murrow.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think as we talk about the needs of our schools and how we can prevent future violence, thinking about how we support youth mental health is a big part of that. So thank you for considering this bill today.
Thank you, Representative Sensenmura. It is an important discussion that we'll continue having. With that, members, I'll give Representative Bakeberg any quick what's happening on Tuesday.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You kind of caught me off guard there. But, Mr. Withers just sent out an update on what is coming up on Tuesday, so just check your email, and that information is there. We look forward to a good discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, members. Please put your House File 3451 in the save file so we can save a tree. And with that, members, we're adjourned.